Okay, so it's of course great to be back, and I'll talk about moduli, inflation and the CMB. This is joint work with Kaushik Datta, who is in the Saha Institute in Kolkata, and the archive number is here. Okay, so for the introduction, well, inflation has emerged as kind of the leading theory for early universe cosmology. And very interestingly, inflation relates late-time cosmological observables, that is the CMB, to the physics of very early times. And in cosmology, of course, early times is very high energies. So a natural question is, what can we learn about the string models from precision CMB and inflation? And this question has been asked in various contexts. And what I'll focus on is inflation, CMB, and the moduli fields that we generically get in string compactifications. Okay, so how do the moduli fields enter? Well, actually, from the very early days of supergravity and string model building, it was realized that a generic implication of having moduli is the possibility of a non-standard cosmological timeline. Okay, this goes by the name of modular cosmology. Okay, and so I'll describe modular cosmology in detail later, but for the purposes of the introduction, I want you to keep in mind that this can occur very generically, and the key feature is that the post-inflationary cosmological history, which is also known as the late-time cosmological history, has an epoch in which the energy density is dominated by cold moduli particles. And the thermal history of the universe that we learn takes place after the decay of these moduli particles and the universe has thermalized. What has happened with the developments in moduli stabilization is that this picture of modular cosmology has been validated in a large class of string models. People are doing detailed phenomenological calculations, sometimes promising calculations. But what I will do is kind of confront this general picture of modular cosmology with precision CMB data and see what we are learning. So before going into the details, let me try to give you a two-slide summary of what the plan is. And to do that, let me start with a statement that's often found in textbooks in inflation. That is that the number of e-foldings between horizon exit of the modes relevant for CMB observations and the end of inflation is between 50 and 60. I'll call this number N inflation. So the central value is usually taken to be 55. This, of course, is a very important statement for the inflationary paradigm, because the way we confront inflationary models with data is that we say, because you can compute the observables such as NS and R in terms of this number, and then you ask, how well are my models doing in comparison to observations? So it's a very important number, but let me kind of remind you of the input which is used at arriving at this statement. And the first is, of course, various cosmological observations. We use various cosmological observations, but we also use the basic form of the standard cosmological timeline. That is that the standard cosmological timeline of inflation, reheating, and then radiation domination, matter domination, and then on to today, is used as a theoretical prior in determining this number. Now, as I told you, that in modular cosmology, the kind of the post-inflationary cosmology is altered. Therefore, this statement should kind of get modified. And since this modular cosmology kind of occurs very generically in string compactifications, we ask the question that essentially the question is, what is the analog of this very well-known statement in the inflationary paradigm for modular cosmology. Okay, so that's the question we asked, and the answer, it might not surprise you, is that the preferred central value of an inflation actually depends on the moduli masses. So this will, of course, have direct implications for inflationary model building. But other than that, what we will see, it will have broader implications, such that for, if we think in the context of supersymmetry breaking, I'll argue that for gravity-mediated models of supersymmetry breaking, there is some kind of relationship between the scale of supersymmetry breaking and the number of e-foldings during inflation. We will also be able to extract a bound on moduli masses based on inflationary observables. So that's where I'm going to, and I'm done with my introduction. So any questions on this part?
Lower bound or an upper bound?
It's an upper bound. So they're bounded from above. Okay, so the plan is as follows. I will review modular cosmology at first. Then I will discuss the number of e-foldings of inflation in the context of modular cosmology, and then we will get into the phenomenological implications. Okay, so because my review is going to be short, let me just give you some of the papers that will kind of get you the details of modular cosmology. These two are reviews, so you can get a lot more references there, and this one also goes into the phenomenological aspects, which I'll not discuss. So okay, first let me get the arena for our analysis right. So we will be looking at models where the moduli have been already stabilized. So for the purposes of this talk, moduli will be massive scalars which interact solely via Planck-suppressed interactions. We'll be not sensitive to precisely the way the moduli are stabilized, so the treatment is going to be fairly general. And then let me just give you some kind of feeling of why modular cosmology is considered to be so generic. Well, with our current understanding of string compactifications, moduli acquire, they're kind of massless at tree level, and they acquire masses from subleading effects in the effective actions, sometimes from non-perturbative effects. So they remain as light fields. And this, together with our present kind of model building preferences for where the Hubble scale during inflation is, so together with these two facts, when people write down explicit models, it is quite common to have the present day mass of moduli to be below Hubble during inflation. And once one has this simple criterion, the simple inequality that one of the moduli has a present day mass below Hubble during inflation, the timeline becomes non-standard and that of modular cosmology. So let me kind of tell you how that sets in, and it's important for us to get the whole timeline straight. So the starting point of the analysis is moduli dynamics during inflation, okay? And this has been well studied in the 80s and 90s. Let me try to illustrate that using a toy model, which is often used in the literature. We have got one modulus, okay? And I've shown the potential terms which are relevant during the inflationary dynamics. So we have a mass term, the second is a curvature term, and then we have got the potential of the inflaton, chi, which drives inflation. So now, of course, in the present epoch, these two terms are not relevant. So m phi is to be thought of as the post-inflationary mass, or what I'll often call just to be mass, okay? So more generally, one important point about the potential is that the potential for the modulus we can think of as kind of the terms contributing to the present day mass, and of course the curvature coupling of the moduli. So you can think of the potential as being composed of two parts. And these two parts, when you look at them separately, there is no reason for them to have the same minimum. So therefore, the minimum of the potential during inflation and the minimum during the present epoch, of course, differ. So therefore, in the kind of toy model, this is put in by saying that the curvature coupling is to phi minus phi hat, and not directly to phi, because phi equals to 0 is the post-inflationary minimum. Of course, this shift, which is kind of the difference of the potential at the two epochs, is something that is model dependent. But one can give very general arguments, which is borne out kind of in the explicit examples that people do, that this field displacement is of the order of 1 in Planck units. So there's a field displacement. So with that, what one does is analyzes the dynamics of inflation with this condition that if the mass of the modulus is less than Hubble during inflation, then one studies the time-dependent problem of how the modulus evolves during inflation. And then at the end of inflation, one finds that the modulus has a VeV phi hat. So essentially, it is kind of driven to its minimum during inflation. Okay? So at the end of inflation, if you think from the perspective of the post-inflationary potential, it is displaced from its minimum. So we are having all these moduli which are displaced from their minima at the end of inflation. So this is the kind of result of this. And after this, the kind of the lightest modulus will dominate the dynamics. Therefore, this single modulus approximation works well. And I'll just stick to it for our discussion. OK, so we've got all these moduli displaced. What happens next? Well, just after reheating, then the energy density of the universe has two components. One is the usual radiation to which the inflaton has dumped its energy. And the second is the kind of the potential energy associated with the modulus because it is displaced from its minimum. Now, if the mass of the modulus is less than Hubble during inflation, that's the kind of regime that we are in, then the former actually dominates.
I mean, immediately after inflation, it dominates.
Yeah. So immediately, this is the story right after reheating where you've got two components. So what happens to these energy densities? Well, the radiation falls off with this 1 over 8 to the power of 4. Initially, although the modulus is kind of displaced from its minimum, because of the high Hubble friction, it remains pinned to its expectation value. But then, with the expansion of the universe, the Hubble falls. And then, almost when the Hubble becomes less than the mass of the modulus begins to oscillate. And the kind of, if one look, one can compute the time average of the energy density associated with this. And one finds that this goes as 1 over a cubed t. So one can essentially think of this whole process as during inflation, you have produced these scalar particles. And they're undergoing cosmological evolution of cold particles, so it's matter-like. The important point is that because this is a cubed compared to a to the power of 4, this quickly dominates over the radiation. And here you see the reason for the alternate timeline, that after radiation domination, we enter this epoch of modulus domination. Okay? So this is, yes.
So are these moduli particles coupled to ordinary radiation or massless particles and then decay?
Yes, so that's what will happen. So they, of course, if this went on forever, we would have ruled out all these models. So of course, the moduli continue to kind of dominate until they decay. And their coupling is via their Planck-suppressed interactions too, because they couple to all matter using Planck-suppressed. So how long does this epoch last? Well, it lasts by, if you just, you know, they have a characteristic lifetime, which goes, because it's decay by these non-renormalizable interactions, it is divided by, it goes as m modulus cubed, 1 over m modulus cubed. And then once these decay, then you again thermalize, and you've got the usual thermal history, okay? So, of course, how long this lasts depends on how heavy your moduli are. So if they're quite heavy, this will be only a small effect and some detour. But okay, so now I have kind of gone through the whole timeline. Let's compare the timeline. Well, you know, this is the conventional timeline. And here we've got this kind of one additional epoch of radiation, modulus domination, reheating, and then you just go on to the usual story. Okay? So of course you want to ask, what is the effect of this epoch on cosmology? What can we say? So, well, I think even in the very early days, people asked this question. And in 1984, thinking about this question, people got a bound on masses of moduli, and this was from nucleosynthesis. So let me go through that argument, because I'd like to compare this bound to the bound that we get later. So to account for the success of BBN, the reheat temperature after modulus decay has to be at least as large as the binding energy of light elements. Okay, and this means that the reheat temperature has to be greater than an MeV. And in this story, one can compute the reheat temperature in terms of the width of the modulus. So one thing that you see is that as the modulus becomes lighter, the reheat temperature becomes lower, because it will live longer and the temperature would have gone down. So lighter the modulus, lower the reheat temperature. So lower bound on the reheat temperature, which is this, translates to a lower bound for the modulus mass. So the modulus have to be bigger than a 30 TeV. Okay, so you just plug in the numbers. You plug in this is one MeV, and you get this. Okay, so now I'm kind of done with my review, and what we decided to do is to look at this modular cosmology story in the context of precision CMB. And what we'll do is that we will also take more input from the inflationary paradigm than before. Okay, so there was the part of the story where inflation implied that the moduli will be displaced, but we'll take more, essentially, more modern input from inflation. And the additional input from inflation is from its success. That is, inflation as a theory of inhomogeneities. And if we accept that inflation is responsible for the theory of inhomogeneities, what this gives us is that we have the observed inhomogeneities, and then it gives us, this relates the observed inhomogeneities to the energy density at a very precise early time. Okay, so from the inhomogeneities, we can know the energy density at a very early time. And more precisely, there is a formula. So AS, which is the dimensionless strength of the inhomogeneities that we observe, is related to the energy density of the universe and also the scalar to tensor ratio. So if we kind of know the inhomogeneities, we know the energy density. Okay, early time, and more very importantly, at a very specific time. That's the time of horizon exit of the modes relevant for CMB observations. Okay, so of course we know AS pretty well. I mean, Planck will just give you a value at what wavelength, and hopefully we'll get a handle of R over soon. And there's a very nice property of this formula, that it is universal. That is because of the freezing of the modes after horizon exit, the formula is insensitive to the details of post-inflationary physics. So we use it in the standard cosmology, but this formula, even if one has this modulus domination epoch, one can still continue to use it. Okay? So now we are in the following situation. That is, that if we treat the time of horizon exit of the pivot mode as t equals to 0, then by determining AS and R, we have, quote unquote, an initial condition for the energy density of the universe. And also, CMB data gives us the energy density of the universe today. And that's by determining the Hubble constant. Okay. But that's the, I mean, it's the mode that there's 0.05 megaparsec inverse. So that's the mode at which they quote all their data. So that's just one given wavelength that they're focusing on. So the situation is as follows. We have got an early time energy density and the energy density today. So whatever history that we ascribe, it must satisfy a consistency condition. That is that this early time energy density evolves to the energy density today. So, well, how is the calculation of N inflation done? Well, you put in your prior about the kind of your post-inflationary epoch, okay? So under the normal circumstances, it's a little bit of reheating, thermal then on. And then you just say that, well, I know I want the evolution from going from here to here, but I know this part in some sense, and from then that I can determine an inflation. And it is this kind of reasoning that gives you this number of that N inflation has to be between 50 and 60 for conventional cosmology.
So where does the 60 come from?
Well, no, so the thing is that when you actually do this calculation, you find the number to be 55. Okay, but then people say that, well, there are uncertainties, like reheating, we haven't done the observations very well, so you give a leeway for plus minus 5. So the effect I'll describe is what, I want to ask this question, so what does this imply for modular cosmology, in particular, what is the central value? Yes?
N inflation could be much larger, that would be consistent with
that. No, but not from the time of the, if you take the time from the time of horizon exit of the pivot mode, inflation could have started way before that.
Does it depend on R?
Huh? You know, it does depend on R. So
how can we say 60?
No, well, this has the kind of usual kind of bias about some model building input. It goes as, there's a dependence which goes as 1 over 4 log of R. So you'd have to make R very small. So under normal circumstances, this kind of the between this and this is 50 to 60. Of course, you know, there could have been a lot of e-foldings before this. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yes, because you're focusing on one mode.
Yeah, one mode, and that. Mode. Yes, that's it. Absolutely. And that's the one that we want to look. You know, when we look for NSNR, this is used as an input, as I'll describe. Okay. So let me just kind of show, because I don't have time to go through the whole calculation. Let me just, for illustration, I'll just show, like, you know, one part of the calculation. So imagine you are in a situation where you know the energy density at rho 1 at some time t1, rho 2 at time t2. There are only two epochs in between, which is matter domination and radiation domination. And at the intermediate time, there's the switch. You can think of this as the decay. So this is the toy example. So suppose I know rho 1 and rho 2. Well, what do? I take log rho 1 over rho 2. So that's a known quantity. I call that k. I insert the intermediate energy densities in the numerator and denominator. So that. And now, in each of the epochs, I know the equation of state. So I can convert the energy densities to the ratios of scale factors. And then once I've got the ratios of the scale factors, that's the numbers of e-folding. So this is how, so this kind of argument will generalize if you have multiple epochs. So the conclusion is, from the knowledge of the energy densities rho 1 and rho 2, a linear combination of the number of e-foldings in the epochs is fixed. Okay, so yes.
So what you're comparing with it at T2 is decoupling, right? That's what we see in the CMB?
No. For me, T2 will be all the way up to, like, today, the Hubble, okay? So I mean,
we're not radiation dominated.
No. So this is a toy example, sorry. Yeah. So I just want this, you should just take as maths, okay, that I just took. I mean, what I'll do is that I'll run it. Where did this go? I'll run it all the way up to today. And this is what, you know, like, as you'll see, this is what people who do inflationary phenomenology also do it. So they have a very similar equation. Yes?
The experimental signature of having this modular cosmology will be what?
So we'll get to it, okay? So, I mean, there are times when you won't have anything there. So let's just talk about, I'll get to that. So that will be the punchline, okay? So now what we have got is we've got our timeline, okay, with various epochs. And in each of the epochs, I can define the number of e-foldings, which is log of the scale factors at the end and beginning. Okay? So for instance, N inflation, as I said, it's kind of number of e-foldings between horizon exit of the pivot mode and the end of inflation. Okay? And you follow the same philosophy as before, but you have to use something extra because you have to know the condition for horizon exit. So you put that in. You also track entropy. And so you do the computation. And as promised, what you get is a relationship between the number of the kind of the various e-foldings that we have got. And you see there is the dependence of R, but this dependence of R is also there in standard cosmology. I'll get back to it. So I should explain, because this is kind of one of our main results, I should explain each term. Well, the N modulus is the number of e-foldings of modulus domination. Okay, N inflation, I've told you before. And then there are the epochs of reheating, which I have the N two reheating epochs, because one after inflation, one after modulus decay. So those are there. W's. What are W's? Well, when people discuss reheating, although reheating can be a very complicated process, you can define a time-averaged effective equation of state during those epochs. So those are the W's. And rho's are the some energy densities which are related to the energy density at the time of horizon exit of the pivot mode and the energy density at the time of inflation. So we could think of plugging these in, but what I really want to do with this equation is compare with what the people from the Planck experiment tell us. Okay? So this is our equation, and this is the equation that Planck writes. Unfortunately, the notation is very different, but I'll just translate for you. Okay? So what we want to compare is this and this. So there it is. So you see that everything is same here, except for this additional N modulus that comes in. Okay? And you see, it's very natural, because in this equation, when people at Planck are writing it, they're sensitive to the post-inflationary physics, because you know, for instance, reheating is post-inflationary physics, and that comes in. Okay? So if you have some other epoch, that's going to come in. And in fact, you can even read off the coefficient from there, because W equals to 0 in these reheating epochs, you get the 1 over 4. So it's very natural to get that. Okay? So we've got that. So what we should do is compute N modulus. That's what we want to do. And that's why I told you the timeline. Well, we know everything about the behavior of the modulus. We know when it begins to oscillate. Okay, so we can compute when it dominates, and we know when it decays. So all one has to do is follow the FRW cosmology, work it out, solve the scale factor as a function of time, and then take the ratios at the beginning and end, and you get the following equation. So you see that it's not surprising, because the time has m Planck divided by m phi, you get, it's essentially related to m Planck divided by m phi. Of course, y is the initial field displacement in Planck units. That had to enter, because if there was never any displacement, then this epoch would not exist. Okay? So you've got, yes?
Uncertainty is there in the decay time. I mean, you just have a twiddle there, but.
Yes, so that would depend on the model. So it could be that you have it's true that
factor of 10 or 100?
Yeah, maybe a factor of 10. And for what I'm going to tell you, in the interesting cases, the factor of 10 is not going to matter. Okay? So the point is that what we wanted to do with this analysis is remain as model independent as we can. So that's why we have a twiddle. This is just what you say because it's Planck suppressed. Okay.
Sorry, you said y equals 0?
So y measured the initial field displacement of the modulus. Now, if it never got displaced, then nothing would happen. Okay. And this is, then you shouldn't be looking at this formula, because this formula assumes that y is non-trivial. But y had to enter the formula. More you displaced, the longer the epoch. Okay. That's.
Yes. What is the modulus supposed to be coupled? Decay to?
So it will decay to standard model radiation. And so you want it to essentially decay, so that you don't want it to decay to some locked to a hidden sector. So they have Planck suppressed couplings to standard model particles, and that's what you want it mostly to decay. You can have dark matter candidates, you want it to decay to that. So that's what the phenomenology of these models has been about, people trying to see if you can get the dark matter density right from this kind of things. Okay, so finally we've got an equation, okay? This is to be thought of as the equation for N inflation. And so let me just kind of, I'll do two implications for phenomenology. The first is kind of direct for inflationary model building. And the second is a bound on the masses of from inflationary observables. So let's go to inflationary model building. So let me remind you how we go about, you know, doing, how we confront a model of inflation with data. Well, we do it by firstly, given a model, NS and R can be computed as a function of N inflation. So this is purely a theoretical computation. So for instance, if I give you M squared chi squared, you can work with that model and you know what NS and R are in terms of N, okay? And having done that, what we do is that we say, how well is the model doing for N inflation around 55, okay? And because of all these uncertainties here, we say that we'll give a leeway of plus minus 5. And those are these lines. You take a model and you draw between 50 and 60, and these are the observations, and you ask, that where are you inside this or not, okay? So this 55 is what motivates the endpoints of these lines, okay? But we kind of have computed essentially the same story for modular cosmology. And you see, if you allow for the same uncertainties, that is the uncertainties with reheating, with R, your inflationary potential, things like that. So, I mean, these things can be estimated. That's why people put this leeway of plus minus 5. So the central value undergoes a shift, okay? So from what we know of as 55 begins to depend on model I. And you can see that this goes as log as of M Planck over M phi. So we'll see that the shift is significant in a large class of models. And if this could be accommodated in the usual leeway of plus minus 5, it's not that interesting. But we'll see that actually in many cases, you will find that it does not fit into the usual leeway of plus minus 5. So that means that you are essentially changing the range from between what you know, draw off as between 50 and 60, you would draw, say, between 40 and 50. And that would make models move, and models that were ruled out can come in. And this is something that you don't choose. You build your string compactification, and you're supposed to see, you compute your moduli masses, and that's going to tell you what this range is supposed to be. So one of the punchlines is that you really need your moduli masses as input for making your precise inflationary predictions. Okay, so let me start, and where is this effect big, okay? Let me start by going to a place which is interesting and where the effect is very pronounced, okay? And that is in models of gravity-mediated supersymmetry breaking, okay? So and in these models, what happens is that both the standard model sector and the moduli sector feel supersymmetry breaking as a result of Planck-suppressed interaction. Yes?
How long can you make an inflation?
I can hit up to 40, I'll say. So, but this is, you'll judge at the end. I mean, I'll give you the formulas and you can.
Why can't you get to one?
Huh?
Can you do one?
I cannot do one because there is already a 30 TeV bound, okay? And I also won't like to do one because there's also the consideration of the horizon problem, okay? So but I can't hit one because I know that they have to, this 30 TeV bound is from nucleosynthesis. If I make it very small, then I'm making the mass way too small and I'd have problem with nucleosynthesis. Okay, so in gravity-mediated models, you should set the mass of the moduli to be same scale as the standard model superpartners, okay? Because they're feeling, both of them are feeling supersymmetry breaking from Planck-suppressed interactions. So let's be kind of liberal about where we want to set that scale, 100 to 1,000 TeV, and a typical value of Y, which is 1 over 10, then you see that the... Well, because, so there was this kind of estimate by that I told you about, Diane Randall Thomas, saying that it's order one. And then there, the models where you compute, you find that to be of order one. So, and by making y smaller, I'm kind of, you know, I'm being conservative, because otherwise the shift would be more. So now, so I put that in, and I find that the shift is as big as 10. Okay. And this is before taking reheating and these things into account. So you could be pushed as low as, if you allow for another 5, you could be pushed into 40. And so a model with n inflation 40, you would essentially discard nowadays. But if it is in the kind of, if there is this modular cosmology, then you would bring it back in. Now, this also has another interesting aspect that, you know, suppose you say that, well, you know, I said 1,000 TeV, but you could say that, well, we have 10 to the power of 4 TeV, and still that's good for naturalness. And the good thing there is that because of this 1 over 3, this is like log base 10. So if you kind of change by the supersymmetry breaking scale by one order of magnitude, this thing only changes by 1. Okay? So what you have is that you have kind of a broad correspondence that between saying that in gravity mediated models, the supersymmetry breaking scale, if there is low energy supersymmetry breaking up to 10 to the power of 4, 10 to the power of 5, then you'll also have a low number of E foldings during inflation.
When you consider a model like that, do you adjust the lifetime of the moduli particles because they're super partners that they can also decay to? Add up all the different possible decay modes in that.
Yes, that's what the people trying to do the phenomenology are doing. But they are guided to this scale because that once you decide what the kind of the scale in standard model is of the super partners, then because supersymmetry breaking is being felt in the same way, you are kind of guided to 100 TeV. And then you have to make sure that you get dark matter right. So there's kind of active phenomenology on this, that is.
But what I'm asking you is, so you had a lifetime parameter that entered your calculation.
Yes.
Do you adjust that depending on the model?
Yes, yes, you would have to. No, yes, of course, of course. So the people would have to, yeah, so you can get factors of 10, as I said.
So that's m Planck squared over m phi cubed, and I guess the point is in a generic model, you would, that you use that, and in a particular model, you would be able to just
compute the numerical coefficient, okay? Okay, so. So one way, just, you know, as a kind of a, you could take the simple, if you want to be very simplistic, then you could say that, well, I'll keep this effect explicitly if n inflation hits 50. Because when if the central value has reached your endpoint, then you better kind of keep it explicitly. It's no longer in the plus minus 5 range. And that happens, so independent of the supersymmetry story, that happens for moduli at as heavy as 10 to the power of 10 GeV, which is a very high number. Usually you would think of, oh, this is something, you know, we had a very short epoch, and then thermalization, there would be nothing happening. But because this is, you know, what determines it is log of M Planck divided by M phi, this is a quite a big effect.
Are there known examples of compactifications with lightest modulus masses that high? I mean, that seems really...
Yeah, so that is, I mean, so you, I mean, that's a very high bound. I just put it in. So you could, I mean, usually you can keep on shrinking the volume, and you could hit this limit. But this is just to show you that for the generic compactification, you should kind of try and put this effect in, okay? And check by how much your N inflation changes and think of how much. Okay. So, well, so far, okay, so how am I doing on time?
20 minutes left.
Okay, 20 minutes left, so I can, okay, I'll go through this part, maybe I'll just go through the important part. So, okay, so now I've done that, but now let me look at the same equation from a different perspective, which is probably going to be how you want to think of it as more precision cosmology data comes in. And that is because, you know, we have been using an inflation as an input for inflationary predictions. So we kind of have been using an inflation in this picture. Okay. So you know, we use an inflation in here, but you could say that once we have more data, then actually, you know, suppose we knew both NS and R, then you would actually start, you know, knowing a specific model without kind of having to resort to N inflation as an input. So, so that means that essentially then, if you've got that, so you know which model of inflation. This could be from non-Gaussianities or things like that, or if you have a preferred model of inflation in string theory. So you're trying to embed a string model into a compactification. You're in that situation. So then you can think of, this is determined by the model of inflation. NS is the spectral tilt. So then you've got, you can determine N inflation from measurements of NS. So this would require very precision NS. And then this equation, you can be thought of as I've moved N inflation to the left-hand side. So the left-hand side is purely kind of post-inflationary. This is all post-inflationary. And the right-hand side is inflationary. OK? So we want to say something about the moduli masses. So we're stuck with reheating. And reheating can take take place by various ways. But so we don't commit to a mechanism for reheating, but explicit numerical and analytic studies strongly suggest that the average effective equation of state for reheating is that W reheating is less than 1 over 3. So it doesn't kind of dilute faster than radiation. So there are exceptions to this, but Planck, you know, if you read the Planck manual, they say that this is what is highly plausible. So if you plug that in, these quantities are positive. Therefore, the maximum value of the term containing the modulus is given by the right-hand side, because these are positive, so the maximum that this can be is this value. So then you have a bound for the mass of the modulus. Okay. So, well, maybe I'll not go into the details, but the kind of this bound is essentially dominated by N inflation. There are the other terms, but you have to make R very small for it to play the role. But the bound kind of a scale is set by N inflation. And again, you see that if you kind of take N inflation 50, you get quite a rather strong bound. This is related to our earlier statement. But when people are doing embedding kind of what? String models into compactifications, this is one thing to keep in mind, that you have a very strong bound. So you can go through the analysis for both small field and large field models. You get similar bounds. OK, so let me come to the conclusions. That is that, well, modular cosmology is very well motivated from the point of string and supergravity models. So there's an epoch in which the energy density is dominated by cold moduli particles. We have examined this in the context, in the light of CMB data and inflation. This suggests that what we know of as 55 actually undergoes a shift, which depends on moduli masses. And the basic argument is quite simple. Okay, it's the following, that how do we determine N inflation? We know the energy densities at the time of horizon exit from inhomogeneities. We know the energy density today. So you have to put in your prior on post-inflationary cosmology. Then you know this, and from that, you determine N inflation. Okay? And if it is just the standard model and an inflaton, then the prior is that you make it all thermal. And then you get this clean number of between 55 and 60. But with our current understanding of string compactifications, there is, of course, you know, there is this post-inflationary epoch can be more complicated. There is a modulus domination epoch. And that means that what we know of as 55 gets a shift, which depends on the mass of the moduli. And I showed you that it can have quite big implications for how we kind of evaluate models of inflation. So when we are thinking of models of inflation in the context of string theory, we really should compute our moduli masses, compute y in the model, plug in the numbers, and check how things go. And this effect is, you know, sizable for moduli up to 10 to the power of 10, Jim. So that's a very big number, as Jim was saying. So most cases, you would have to try and worry about this. And then the shift went as M Planck divided by M modulus. And for gravity-mediated models, that's just the hierarchy. Because of this 1 over 3, this becomes the log. So you have a relationship between supersymmetry breaking scale and the number of e-foldings during inflation. And then, and with a preferred model of inflation, which is probably what we're going to learn of in the future, that we have a bound on moduli masses with a potential equality with understanding of reheating. So if you put in the reheating terms, you would know. OK, so that's. Yes.
I should have thought your canonical model would have been one we had a gut scale.
A gut scale moduli?
No.
Or so.
Phase unification. At what scale wouldn't that?
So let me bring this. Where is?
I think he's questioning the assumption of Planck scale interaction suppression.
No, these fields you can check that they come from the higher dimensional metric, so the thing is set by the Planck scale. And if are you saying where is the gut scale? The gut scale will be the scale where kind of close to this, where the kind of you have the Hubble, and so the value of the inflationary potential. That during inflation, the typical value is to take the gut scale. So yes, the gut scale is there. So, but
you're saying the gut scale precedes this period of modulus domination.
The gut scale will precede because of this. So you can have this happening because of this situation where did that go? That's very early on. That way out here, that initially it is stuck because of the Hubble friction. So then it slowly dominates. So at the gut scale, it is all radiation. And then the modulus takes over. So, and this depends on, it depends on what your Hubble was. Yes, so the preferred value would be to have the Hubble such that V inflation is close to gut. But we don't make direct use of that. So the gut is kind of, where did I go through the two times? The gut could be somewhere here or something like this.
Somewhere.
Here, right after inflation. That's the gut, that could be close to gut.
Why does the moduli, you have gut symmetry breaking, and then these moduli persist?
Yes, they persist because they're very weakly coupled. That's the thing. They're produced during inflation, very weakly coupled, so they can last for long. That's how they're surviving.
And their mass is less
than. Yeah, but you could think of their masses being even quite low. The bounds are just nucleosynthesis, nothing else. So. And the thing is that at order zero, they're.
Well, you're making an assumption nothing else happens. There might be other.
So you would have to make him.
Someplace.
Yeah, so you'd have to put that in. And in this 55 to 60, there are improvements of that by putting that in. So one would just have to kind of put in all those effects. But this shift is something that you would get. Hopefully, the other part of the story would. Yes?
Can you put a bound on the number of moduli? It seems like. You have too many.
Yes, you would run into, because this we have studied the case in which there are just n moduli, okay, and then of course this effect, the n doesn't come outside the log, the n is inside the log, so it's not a very big effect, but if you know the kind of it was not a diagonal system, then you would have slightly, yes, but n can come in. So if you have a large number of moduli, but then it becomes tricky that because all of them have some initial displacement, and you can't expect that, you know, because of n moduli, you actually get some Planck scale energy density. It can't increase with n arbitrarily. So one has to study that dynamics in detail. So for small, so the good thing is that because this goes as 1 over m phi cubed, the lifetime, if there is one parametrically lightest, or even if it is, you know, three times lightest, then it dominates. So it's used as a good approximation. Because the usual timeline people have studied for in the context of BBN, because they want to know about this 30 TeV bound. They want to understand whether it's 30 TeV or 50 TeV by putting in n moduli. So that's, so there has been work on it, and it's a complicated story. It's not, but for a small number of moduli, it's clear that the bound will get, like, essentially you will get a bigger shift. But if you think of the large n limit, it's more complicated.
So do I understand, so the basic, one of the basic points is that the CMB experiments are, this shift is an appreciable effect for moduli masses up to 10 to the 10 GeV.
Yeah, yeah.
A relevant comment that is totally in support of your work that you make is that the typical non-thermal dark matter production is sensitive to a much smaller range of moduli masses. So this is actually good because the experiments are way more sensitive.
Yes, 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 exactly. So I mean, one like, you know, in Michigan, I was talking to these people and they were saying that, yes, this is kind of, and what you know, what some people are trying to do is kind of try and see whether you get, because in the non-thermal story, you can, I mean, this modular cosmology is also called non-thermal. And in the non-thermal story, you can think of structure formation. And you can see whether there is a correlation between the two in the answers. And this would be one way to see that, because here it is quite simple to do the calculation. Structure formation, like, you know, galaxy formation, again, from the inhomogeneities.
That's right.
Yeah, and see.
So there's structure formation issues, but then there's even just, are you recovering a different dark matter
scenario
issues?
Yes.
And once the modulus is above about 100 TeV,
yeah,
you are recovering the normal thermal scenario and everything's
yes,
the same.
Yes.
So this is much more sensitive. Which
yes,
is cool.
It is much more sensitive. Yeah.
What happens, what is supposed to determine the initial displacement?
So it is like, if you give me a model, I can actually compute it because, oh, okay, so let me see, you can,
Related question, has it been computed in LDS?
Yes, it has, and you find of the order of. What should I say? So you just have to compute the moduli potential, and compute the shift. So unfortunately, there are not many models in string compactifications where we have that kind of precision control. So where we can, we compute it. But what these people showed is that it has nothing to do with the Hubble, because the Hubble kind of, you could have said, is it M Planck or M Hubble? But they showed that the Hubble just kind of just factors outside the potential. So the kind of the worry that, because the energy density is of the order of Hubble, this was a light field, it could just be displaced some Hubble or some, you know, some square root of Hubble times M Planck or something. That's not happening. That's what these people have showed. And then where you can look at it, you know the answer, so that's one thing one should be computing.
Do you have the LVS expression somewhere on your slides for one?
No,
Do you know who computed it?
Well, I don't think it's in print. So one thing you can think of it, people talk of like uplifting. Okay, so essentially it's the question of how does the modulus shift when you are kind of putting in the inflationary sector. And it is going to react, okay? Because, you know, essentially you're thinking of taking, because today's cosmological constant is almost zero. And then you want to take it to be something, you know, say 10 to the power of 11 or 12, and there's going to be a kind of reaction. And also the kind of, the what gets you is also the canonical normalized field. Typically volume is the lightest, goes as e to the power of volume. So it's, unless you land right at one, you're going to get an order one.
Okay.